But the boy either didn't understand him or didn't want to. Then he grasped the far end of the crowbar and pushed on it. His arms were thin but belted with a scrawny sort of muscle, the kind of muscle that working men from poor families always seem to have. The plate tilted a little, but didn't come up enough for Larry to get his fingers under. "Lay over it," he said. Those half-savage, up-tilted eyes studied him coolly for a moment, and then Joe balanced on the crowbar, his feet coming off the ground as his whole weight was thrown onto the lever. The plate came up a little farther than before, enough so that Larry could squirm his fingers under it. While he was struggling for purchase, he happened to think that if the boy still didn't like him, this was the best chance he could have to show it. If Joe took his weight off the crowbar, the plate would come down with a crash and he'd lose everything on his hands but the thumbs. Nadine had realized this, Larry saw. She had been peering at one of the bikes, but now had turned to watch, her body angled into a posture of tension. Her dark eyes went from Larry, down on one knee, to Joe, who was watching Larry as he leaned his weight on the bar. Those seawater eyes were inscrutable, and still Larry couldn't find purchase.
"Need help?" Nadine asked,
her normally calm voice now just a little high-pitched. Sweat ran into one eye, and he blinked it away. Still no joy. He could smell gasoline.
"I think we can handle it," Larry said, looking directly at her.
A moment later, his fingers slipped into a short groove on the underside of the plate. He threw his shoulders into it, and the plate came up and crashed over on the tarmac with a dull clang. He heard Nadine sigh and the crowbar fall to the pavement. He wiped his perspiring brow and looked back at the boy.
"That's good work, Joe," he said. "If you'd let that thing slip, I would have spent the rest of my life zipping my fly with my teeth. Thank you."
He expected no response, except perhaps an uninterpretable hoot as Joe walked back to inspect the motorcycles again. But Joe said in a rusty, struggling voice,
"Whack 'em."
Larry flashed a glance at Nadine, who stared back at him and then at Joe. Her face was surprised and pleased, yet somehow she looked, he couldn't have said just how, as if she had expected this. It was an expression he had seen before, but not one he could put his finger on right away.
"Joe," he said, "did you say welcome?"
Joe nodded vigorously.
"Whack'em. You whack'em."
Nadine was holding her arms out, smiling.
"That's good, Joe. Very, very good."
Joe trotted to her and allowed himself to be hugged for a moment or two. Then he began to peer at the bikes again, hooting and chuckling to himself.
"He can talk," Larry said.
"I knew he wasn't mute," Nadine answered, "but it's wonderful to know he can recover. I think he needed two of us. Two halves. I don't know." He saw that she was blushing and thought he knew why. He began to slip the length of rubber hose into the hole in the cement, and suddenly realized that what he was doing could easily be interpreted as a symbolic, and rather crude, bit of dumb show. He looked up at her sharply. She turned away quickly, but not before he had seen how intently she was watching what he was doing, and the high color in her cheeks. The nasty fear rose in his chest, and he called, "For Christ's sake, Nadine, look out!" She was concentrating on the hand controls, not looking where she was going, and she was going to drive the Honda directly into a pine tree at a wobbling 5 miles an hour. She looked up, and he heard her say, "Oh!" in a startled voice. Then she swerved, much too sharply, and fell off the bike. The Honda stalled. He ran to her, his heart in his throat.
"Are you all right, Nadine? Are you—"
Then she was picking herself up shakily, looking at her scraped hands.
"Yes, I'm fine. Stupid me, not looking where I was going. Did I hurt the motorcycle?"
"Never mind the goddamn motorcycle. Let me take a look at your hands." She held them out, and he took a plastic bottle of Bactine from his pants pocket and sprayed them.
"You're shaking," she said.
"Never mind that either," Larry answered, more roughly than he had intended. "Listen, maybe we had better just stick to the bicycles. This is dangerous."
"So is breathing," she answered calmly.
"And I think Joe should ride with you, at least at first."
"He won't—"
"I think he will," Nadine said, looking into his face.
"And so do you." Well, let's stop for tonight. It's almost too dark to see. Once more, haven't I read that if your horse throws you, you should get right back on? Joe strolled by, munching blueberries from a motorcycle helmet. He had found a number of wild blueberry bushes behind the dealership and had been picking them while Nadine had her first lesson.
I guess so, Larry said, defeated. But will you please watch where you're going?
Yes, sir. Right, sir.
She saluted and then smiled at him. She had a beautiful, slow smile that lit up her whole face. Larry smiled back. There was nothing else to do. When Nadine smiled, even Joe smiled back.
This time she putted around the lot twice and then turned out into the road, swinging over too sharply, bringing Larry's heart into his mouth again. But she brought her foot down smartly, as he had shown her, and went up the hill and out of sight. He saw her switch carefully up to second gear and heard her switch to third as she dropped behind the first rise. Then the bike's engine faded to a drone that melted away to nothing. He stood anxiously in the twilight, absently slapping at an occasional mosquito. Joe strolled by again, his mouth blue.
"Weckum," he said, and grinned.
Larry managed a strained smile in return. If she didn't come back soon, he would go after her. Visions of finding her lying in a ditch with a broken neck danced blackly in his head. He was just walking over to the other cycle, debating whether or not to take Joe with him, when the droning hum came to his ears again and swelled to the sound of the Honda's engine, clocking smoothly along in fourth. He relaxed. A little. Dismally, he realized he would never be able to relax completely while she was riding that thing. She came back into sight, the cycle's headlamp now on, and pulled up beside him.
"Pretty good, huh?"
She switched off.
"I was getting ready to come after you. I thought you'd had an accident."
"I sort of did." She saw the way he stiffened and added, "I went too slow turning around and forgot to push the clutch in. I stalled."
"Oh. Enough for tonight, huh?"
"Yes," she said. "My tailbone hurts." He lay in his blankets that night, wondering if she might come to him when Joe was asleep, or if he should go to her. He wanted her, and thought, from the way she had looked at the absurd little pantomime with the rubber hose earlier, that she wanted him. At last he fell asleep. He dreamed he was in a field of corn, lost there. But there was music, guitar music, Joe playing the guitar. If he found Joe, he would be all right. So he followed the sound, breaking through one row of corn to the next when he had to, at last coming out in a ragged clearing. There was a small house there, more of a shack, really, the porch held up with rusty old jacklifters. It wasn't Joe playing the guitar. How could it have been? Joe was holding his left hand and Nadine his right. They were with him. An old woman was playing the guitar, a jazzy sort of spiritual that had Joe smiling. The old woman was black, and she was sitting on the porch, and Larry guessed she was just about the oldest woman he had ever seen in his life. But there was something about her that made him feel good. Good in the way his mother had once made him feel good when he was very little, and she would suddenly hug him and say, "Here's the best boy. Here's Alice Underwood's all-time best boy." The old woman stopped playing and looked up at them.
"Well, say, I got me company. Step on out where I can see you. My peepers ain't what they once was."
So they came closer, the three of them hand in hand, and Joe reached out and set a bald old tire swing to slow pendulum movement as they passed it. The tire's donut-shaped shadow slipped back and forth on the weedy ground. They were in a small clearing, an island in a sea of corn. To the north, a dirt road stretched away to a point.
"You like to have a swing on this old box of mine?" she asked Joe.
And Joe came forward eagerly and took the old guitar from her gnarled hands. He began to play the tune they had followed through the corn, but better and faster than the old woman.
"Bless him, he plays good. Me, I'm too old. Can't make my fingers go that fast now. It's the rheumatiz. But in 1902 I played at the county hall. I was the first Negro to ever play there, the very first."
Nadine asked who she was.
They were in a kind of forever place where the sun seemed to stand still 1 hour from darkness, and the shadow of the swing Joe had set in motion would always travel back and forth across the weedy yard. Larry wished he could stay here forever, he and his family. This was a good place. The man with no face could never get him here, or Joe, or Nadine.
Mother Abigail is what they call me. I'm the oldest woman in eastern Nebraska, I guess, and I still make my own biscuits. You come see me as quick as you can. We got to go before he gets wind of us.
A cloud came over the sun. The swing's arc had decreased to nothing. Joe stopped playing with a jangling rattle of strings, and Larry felt the hackles rise on the back of his neck. The old woman seemed not to notice.
"Before who gets wind of us?" Nadine asked,
and Larry wished he could speak, cry out for her to take the question back before it could leap free and hurt them.
"That black man, that servant of the devil. We got the Rockies between us and him, praise God, but they won't keep him back. That's why we got to knit together. In Colorado. God come to me in a dream and showed me where. But we got to be quick, quick as we can anyway. So you come see me. There's others coming, too."
"No," Nadine said in a cold and fearful voice. "We're going to Vermont, that's all, only to Vermont. Just a short trip."
"Your trip will be longer than ours if and you don't fight off his power," the old woman in Larry's dream replied.
She was looking at Nadine with great sadness.
"This could be a good man you got here, woman. He wants to make something out of himself. Why don't you cleave to him instead of using him?"
"No, we're going to Vermont. To Vermont!"
The old woman looked at Nadine pityingly.
"You go straight to hell if you don't watch close, daughter of Eve. And when you get there, you are going to find that hell is cold."
The dream broke up then, splitting into cracks of darkness that swallowed him. But something in that darkness was stalking him. It was cold and merciless, and soon he would see its grinning teeth. But before that could happen, he was awake. It was half an hour after dawn, and the world was swaddled in a thick white ground fog that would burn off when the sun got up a little more. Now the motorcycle dealership rose out of it like some strange ship's prow constructed of cinder block instead of wood. Someone was next to him, and he saw that it wasn't Nadine who had joined him in the night, but Joe. The boy lay next to him, thumb corked in his mouth, shivering in his sleep, as if his own nightmare had gripped him. Larry wondered if Joe's dreams were so different from his own. And he lay on his back, staring up into the white fog, and thinking about that until the others woke up an hour later. The fog had burned off enough to travel by the time they had finished breakfast and packed their things on the cycles. As Nadine had said, Joe showed no qualms about riding behind Larry. In fact, he climbed on Larry's cycle without having to be asked.
"Slow," Larry said for the fourth time. "We're not going to hurry and have an accident."
"Fine," Nadine said. "I'm really excited. It's like being on a quest."
She smiled at him, but Larry could not smile back. Rita Blakemore had said something very much like that when they were leaving New York City. 2 days before she died, she had said it. They stopped for lunch in Epsom, eating fried ham from a can and drinking orange soda under the tree where Larry had fallen asleep, and Joe had stood over him with the knife. Larry was relieved to find that riding the motorcycle wasn't as bad as he had thought it would be. In most of the places they could make fairly decent time, and even going through the villages it was only necessary to putt along the sidewalks at walking speed. Nadine was being extremely careful about slowing down on blind curves, and even on the open road she did not urge Larry to go any faster than the steady 35 miles an hour pace he was setting. He thought that, barring bad weather, they could be in Stovington by the 19th. They stopped for supper west of Concord, where Nadine said they could save time on Lauder and Goldsmith's route by going directly northwest on the thruway, I-89. "There will be a lot of stalled traffic," Larry said doubtfully.
"We can weave in and out," she said with confidence, "and use the breakdown lane when we have to. The worst that can happen is we'll have to backtrack to an exit and go around on a secondary road." They tried it for 2 hours after supper, and did indeed come upon a blockage from one side of the northbound lanes to the other. Just beyond Warner, a car and house trailer combo had jackknifed. The driver and his wife, weeks dead, lay like grain sacks in the front seat of their Electra. The three of them, working together, were able to hoist the bikes over the buckled hitch between the car and the trailer. Afterward, they were too tired to go any farther, and that night Larry didn't ponder whether or not to go to Nadine, who had taken her blankets 10 feet farther down from where he had spread his. The boy was between them. That night he was too tired to do anything but fall asleep. The next afternoon they came upon a block they couldn't get around. A trailer truck had overturned, and half a dozen cars had crashed behind it. Luckily, they were only 2 miles beyond the Enfield exit. They went back, took the exit ramp, and then, feeling tired and discouraged, stopped in the Enfield Town Park for a 20-minute rest. "What did you do before, Nadine?" Larry asked. He had been thinking about the expression in her eyes when Joe had finally spoken. The boy had added, "Larry, Nadine, thanks, and go bathroom," to his working vocabulary. And now he made a guess based on that. "Were you a teacher?" She looked at him with surprise. "Yes, that's a good guess." "Little kids?" "That's right, first and second graders." That explained something about her complete unwillingness to leave Joe behind. In mind, at least, the boy had regressed to a 7-year-old age level. "How did you guess?" "A long time ago, I used to date a speech therapist from Long Island," Larry said. "I know that sounds like the start of one of those involved New York jokes, but it's the truth. She worked for the Ocean View school system. Younger grades, kids with speech impediments, cleft palates, hair lips, deaf kids. She used to say that correcting speech defects in children was just showing them an alternative way of getting the right sounds. Show them, say the word. Show them, say the word. Over and over until something in the kid's head clicked. And when she talked about that click happening, she looked the way you did when Joe said, 'You're welcome.'"
"Did I?"
She smiled a little wistfully.
"I loved the little ones. Some of them were bruised, but none of them at that age are irrevocably spoiled. The little ones are the only good human beings."
"Kind of a romantic idea, isn't it?"
She shrugged. "Children are good. And if you work with them, you get to be a romantic. That's not so bad."
"Wasn't your speech therapist friend happy in her work?"
"Yeah, she liked it," Larry agreed.
"Were you married before?"
There it was again. That simple, ubiquitous word, before. It was only 2 syllables, but it had become all-encompassing.
"Married? No, never married." She began to look nervous again.
"I'm the original old maid school teacher, younger than I look but older than I feel. 37.
His eyes had moved to her hair before he could stop them, and she nodded as if he had spoken out loud.
"It's premature," she said matter-of-factly. "My grandmother's hair was totally white by the time she was 40. I think I'm going to last at least 5 years longer."
"Where did you teach?"
"A small private school in Pittsfield. Very exclusive. Ivy-covered walls, all the newest playground equipment. Damn the recession, full speed ahead. The carpool consisted of 2 Thunderbirds, 3 Mercedes-Benzes, a couple of Lincolns, and a Chrysler Imperial."
"You must have been very good."
"Yes, I think I was," she said artlessly, then smiled. "Doesn't matter much now."
He put an arm around her. She started a little, and he felt her stiffen. Her hand and shoulder were warm.
"I wish you wouldn't," she said uncomfortably.
"You don't want me to?"
"No, I don't."
He drew his arm back, baffled. She did want him to, that was the thing. He could feel her wanting coming off her in mild but clearly receivable waves. Her color was very high now, and she was looking desperately down at her hands, which were fiddling together in her lap like a couple of hurt spiders. Her eyes were shiny, as if she might be on the verge of tears.
"Nadine?"
"Honey, is that you?"
She looked up at him, and he saw she was past the verge of tears. She was about to speak when Joe strolled up, carrying his guitar case in one hand. They looked at him guiltily, as if he had found them doing something rather more personal than talking.
"Lady," Joe said conversationally.
"What?" Larry asked, startled and not tracking very well.
"Lady,"
Joe said again and jerked his thumb back over his shoulder. Larry and Nadine looked at each other. Suddenly there was a fourth voice, high-pitched and choking with emotion, as startling as the voice of God.
"Thank heaven!" it cried. "Oh, thank heaven!"
They stood up and looked at the woman who was now half running up the street toward them. She was smiling and crying at the same time.
"Glad to see you," she said. "I'm so glad to see you, thank heaven."
She swayed and might have fainted if Larry hadn't been there to steady her until her dizziness passed. He guessed her age at about 25. She was dressed in blue jeans and a plain white cotton blouse. Her face was pale, her blue eyes unnaturally fixed. Those eyes stared at Larry as if trying to convince the brain behind them that this was not a hallucination, that the three people she saw were really here. "I'm Larry Underwood," he said. "The lady is Nadine Cross. The boy is Joe. We're very happy to meet you." The woman continued to stare at him wordlessly for a moment, and then walked slowly away from him and toward Nadine.
"I'm so pleased," she began. "So pleased to meet you."
She stumbled a little.
"Oh my God, are you really people?"
"Yes," Nadine said. The woman put her arms around Nadine and sobbed. Nadine held her. Joe stood in the street by a stalled pickup truck, his guitar case in one hand, his free thumb in his mouth. At last he went to Larry and looked up at him. Larry held his hand. The two of them stood that way and watched the woman solemnly. And that was how they met Lucy Swan. She was eager to go with them when they told her where they were headed, and that they had reason to believe there were at least two other people there, and possibly more. Larry found a medium-sized knapsack for her in the Enfield Sporting Goods, and Nadine went down to her house on the outskirts of town to help her pack. Two changes of clothes, some underwear, an extra pair of shoes, a raincoat, and pictures of her late husband and daughter. They camped that night in a town called Queechee, now over the state line and into Vermont. Lucy Swan told a tale which was short and simple and not much different from the others they would hear. The grief came built in, and the shock which had driven her at least within hailing distance of madness. Her husband had sickened on the 25th of June, her daughter the next day. She had nursed them as well as she had been able, fully expecting to come down with the rails, as they were calling the sickness in her corner of New England, herself. By the 27th, when her husband had gone into a coma, Enfield was pretty much cut off from the outside world. Television reception had become spotty and queer. People were dying like flies. During the previous week, they had seen extraordinary movements of army troops along the turnpike, but none of them had business in such a little place as Enfield, New Hampshire. In the early morning hours of June 28th, her husband had died. Her daughter had seemed a little bit better for a while on the 29th, and then had taken an abrupt turn for the worst that evening. She had died around 11 o'clock. By July 3rd, everyone in Enfield except her and an old man named Bill Dads had died. Bill had been sick, Lucy said, but he seemed to have thrown it off entirely. Then, on the morning of Independence Day, she had found Bill dead on Main Street, swollen up and black, like everyone else. "So I buried my people, and Bill too," she said as they sat around the crackling fire. "It took all of one day, but I put them to rest. Then I thought that I'd better go on down to Concord, where my mother and father live. But I just never got around to it." She looked at them appealingly. "Was it so wrong? Do you think they would have been alive?" "No," Larry said. "The immunity sure wasn't hereditary in any direct way. My mother..." He looked into the fire. "Wes and me, we had to get married," Lucy said. "That was the summer after I graduated high school, 1984. My mom and dad didn't want me to marry him. They wanted me to go away to have the baby and just give her up. But I wouldn't. My mom said it would end in divorce. My dad said Wes was a no-account man and he'd always be shiftless,
I just said that may be, but we'll see what happens. I just wanted to take the chance, you know?
Yes, Nadine said. She was sitting next to Lucy, looking at her with great compassion.
We had a nice little home, and I sure never thought it would end like this, Lucy said with a sigh that was half a sob. We settled down real good, the three of us. It was more Marcy than me that settled Westdown. He thought the sun rose and set on that baby.
He thought...
Don't, Nadine said. All that was before.
That word again, Larry thought. That little two-syllable word.
Yes, it's gone now. And I guess I could have gotten along. I was, anyway, until I started to have all those bad dreams.
Larry's head jerked up.
Dreams?
Nadine was looking at Joe. A moment before, the boy had been nodding out in front of the fire. Now he was staring at Lucy, his eyes gleaming.
Bad dreams, nightmares, Lucy said. They're not always the same. Mostly it's a man chasing me, and I can never see exactly what he looks like, because he's all wrapped up in a, what do you call it, a cloak. And he stays in the shadows and alleys.
She shivered.
I got so I was afraid to go to sleep. But now maybe I'll...
Brackman! Joe cried suddenly, so fierce they all jumped. He leaped to his feet and held his arms out like a miniature Bela Lugosi, his fingers hooked into claws.
Brackman! Bad dreams! Chases me! Cares me!
And he shrank against Nadine and stared untrustingly into the darkness. A little silence fell among them.
This is crazy, Larry said, and then stopped.
They were all looking at him. Suddenly the darkness seemed very dark indeed, and Lucy looked frightened again. He forced himself to go on.
Lucy, do you ever dream about, well, about a place in Nebraska?
I had a dream one night about an old Negro woman, Lucy said, but it didn't last very long. She said something like, "You come see me." Then I was back in Enfield, and that scary guy was chasing me. Then I woke up.
Larry looked at her so long that she colored and dropped her eyes. He looked at Joe.
Joe, do you ever dream about, corn? An old woman? A guitar?
Joe only looked at him from Nadine's encircling arm.
Leave him alone, you'll upset him more, Nadine said,
but she was the one who sounded upset. Larry thought.
A house, Joe? A little house with a porch up on Jack's?
He thought he saw a gleam in Joe's eyes.
Stop it, Larry, Nadine said. A swing, Joe? A swing made out of a tire?
Joe suddenly jerked in Nadine's arms. His thumb came out of his mouth. Nadine tried to hold him, but Joe broke through.
The swing, Joe said exultantly. The swing, the swing!
He whirled away from them and pointed first at Nadine, then at Larry.
Her... You, lots.
Lots? Larry asked, but Joe had subsided again. Lucy Swan looked stunned.
The swing, she said. I remember that, too.
She looked at Larry.
Why are we all having the same dreams? Is somebody using a ray on us?
I don't know. He looked at Nadine. Have you had them, too?
I don't dream, she said sharply, and immediately dropped her eyes.
He thought... You're lying. But why?
Nadine, if you... I told you I don't dream, Nadine cried sharply, almost hysterically. Can't you just leave me alone? Do you have to badger me?
She stood up and left the fire, almost running. Lucy looked after her uncertainly for a moment and then stood up.
I'll go after her.
Yes, you better. Joe, stay with me, okay?
Kay,
Joe said, and began to unsnap the guitar case. Lucy came back with Nadine 10 minutes later. They had both been crying, Larry saw, but they seemed to be on good terms now.
I'm sorry, Nadine said to Larry. It's just that I'm always upset. It comes out in funny ways.
It's all right. The subject did not come up again. They sat and listened to Joe run through his repertoire. He was getting very good indeed now, and in with the hootings and grunts, fragments of the lyrics were coming through. At last they slept,
Larry on one end, Nadine on the other, Joe and Lucy between. Larry dreamed first of the black man on the high place, then of the old black woman sitting on her porch. Only in this dream he knew the black man was coming, striding through the corn, knocking his own twisted swathe through the corn, his terrible hot grin spot-welded to his face, coming toward them, closer and closer. Larry woke up in the middle of the night, out of breath, his chest constricted with terror. The others slept like stones. Somehow, in that dream, he had known. The black man had not been coming empty-handed. In his arms, borne like an offering as he strode through the corn, he held the decaying body of Rita Blakemore, now stiff and swollen, the flesh ripped by woodchucks and weasels. A mute accusation to be thrown at his feet, to scream his guilt at the others, to silently proclaim that he wasn't no nice guy, that something had been left out of him, that he was a loser, that he was a taker. At last he slept again, and until he woke up the next morning at 7, stiff, cold, hungry, and needing to go to the bathroom, his sleep was dreamless.
"Oh, God," Nadine said emptily.
Larry looked at her and saw a disappointment too deep for tears. Her face was pale, her remarkable eyes clouded and dull. It was 7:15, July 19th, and the shadows were drawing long. They had ridden all day, their few rest stops only 5 minutes long, their lunch break, which they had taken in Randolph, only half an hour. None of them had complained, although after 6 hours on a cycle, Larry's whole body felt numb and achy and full of pins. Now they stood together in a line outside a wrought iron fence. Below and behind them lay the town of Stovington, not much changed from the way Stu Redman had seen it on his last couple of days in this institution. Beyond the fence and a lawn that had once been well kept, but which was now shaggy and littered by sticks and leaves that had blown into it during afternoon thunderstorms, was the institution itself, 3 stories high. More of it buried underground, Larry surmised. The place was deserted, silent, empty. In the center of the lawn was a sign which read, "Stovington Plague Control Center. This is a government installation. Visitors must check in at main desk." Beside it was a second sign, and this was what they were looking at. "Route 7 to Rutland. Route 4 to Schuylerville, Route 29 to I-87, I-87 South to I-90, I-90 West. Everyone here is dead. We are moving west to Nebraska. Stay on our route. Watch for signs. Harold Emery Lauder, Francis Goldsmith, Stuart Redman, Glendon Pequod Bateman. July 8th, 1990.
"Harold, my man," Larry murmured. "Can't wait to shake your hand and buy you a beer.
Or a payday."
"Larry," Lucy said sharply.
Nadine had fainted. Chapter 45. She tottered out onto her porch at 10:40 on the morning of July 20th, carrying her coffee and her toast with her as she did every day that the Coca-Cola thermometer outside the sink window read over 50 degrees. It was high summer, the finest summer Mother Abigail could recollect since 1955, the year her mother had died at the goodish age of 93. "Too bad there ain't more folks around to enjoy it," she thought, as she sat carefully down in her armless rocking chair. But did they ever enjoy it? Some did, of course. Young folks in love did, and old folks whose bones remembered so clearly what the death clutch of winter was. Now most of the young folks and old folks were gone, and most of those in between. God had brought down a harsh judgment on the human race. Some might argue with such a harsh judgment, but Mother Abigail was not among their number. He had done it once with water, and sometime further along he would do it with fire. Her place was not to judge God, although she wished he hadn't seen fit to set the cup before her lips that he had. But when it came to matters of judgment, she was satisfied with the answer God had given Moses from the burning bush, when Moses had seen fit to question. "Who are you?" Moses asks, and God comes back from that bush just as pert as you like.
I am who I am.
In other words, Mose, stop beating around this here bush and get your old ass in gear.
She wheezed laughter and nodded her head and dipped her toast into the wide mouth of her coffee cup until it was soft enough to chew. It had been 16 years since she had bid hail and farewell to her last tooth. Toothless she had come from her mother's womb, and toothless she would go into her own grave. Molly, her great-granddaughter, and her husband had given her a set of false teeth for Mother's Day just a year later, the year she herself had been 93, but they hurt her gums, and now she only wore them when she knew Molly and Jim were coming. Then she would take them from the box in the drawer and rinse them off good and stick them in. And if she had time before Molly and Jim came, she would make faces at herself in the spotty kitchen mirror and growl through all those big white fake teeth and laugh fit to split. She looked like an old black Everglades gator. She was old and feeble, but her mind was pretty much in order. Abigail Fremantle was her name, born in 1882 and with the birth certificate to prove it. She'd seen a heap during her time on the earth, but nothing to match the goings-on of the last month or so. No, there never had been such a thing, and now her time was coming to be a part of it, and she hated it. She was old. She wanted to rest and enjoy the cycle of the seasons between now and whenever God got tired of watching her make her daily round and decided to call her home to glory. But what happened when you questioned God? The answer you got was, I am who I am, and that was the end. When his own son prayed that the cup be taken from his lips, God never even answered. And she wasn't up to that snuff, no how, no way. Just an ordinary sinner was all she was, and at night, when the wind came up and blew through the corn, it frightened her to think that God had looked down at a little baby girl poking out between her mother's legs back in early 1882, and had said to himself, I got to keep her around a goodish time. She's got work in 1990 on the other side of a whole heap of calendar pages. Her time here in Hemmingford home was coming to an end, and her final season of work lay ahead of her in the west, near the Rocky Mountains. He had sent Moses to mountain climbing and Noah to boat building. He had seen his own son nailed up on a tree. What did he care how miserably afraid Abby Fremantle was of the man with no face? He, who stalked her dreams. She never saw him. She didn't have to see him. He was a shadow passing through the corn at noon, a cold pocket of air, a gore crew peering down at you from the phone lines. His voice called to her in all the sounds that had ever frightened her. Spoken soft, it was the tick of a death watch beetle under the stairs, telling that someone loved would soon pass over. Spoken loud, it was the afternoon thunder rolling amid the clouds that came out of the west like boiling Armageddon. And sometimes there was no sound at all but the lonely rustle of the night wind in the corn, but she would know he was there. And that was the worst of all, because then the man with no face seemed only a little less than God himself. At those times, it seemed that she was within touching distance of the dark angel that had flown silently over Egypt, killing the firstborn of every house where the doorpost wasn't daubed with blood. That frightened her most of all. She became a child again in her fear, and knew that while others knew of him and were frightened by him, only she had been given a clear vision of his terrible power. "Well-a-day," she said, and popped the last bite of toast into her mouth. She rocked back and forth, drinking her coffee. This was a bright, fine day, and no part of her body was giving her particular misery, and she offered up a brief prayer of thanksgiving for what she had got. God is great, God is good. The littlest child could learn those words, and they encompassed the whole world and all the world held, good and evil. God is great, Mother Abigail said. God is good. Thank you for the sunshine, for the coffee, for the fine BM I had last night. You was right, those dates turned the trick, but my God, they taste nasty to me. Ain't I the one? God is great. Her coffee was about gone. She set the cup down and rocked, her face turned up to the sun like some strange living rock face, seamed with veins of coal.
She dozed, then slept. Her heart, its walls now almost as thin as tissue paper, beat on and on as it had every minute for the last 39,630 days. Like a baby in a crib, you would have had to put your hand on her chest to assure yourself that she was breathing at all. But the smile stayed on. Things had surely changed in all the years since she had been a girl. The Fremantles had come to Nebraska as freed slaves, and Abigail's own great-grandmother Molly laughed in a nasty, cynical way and suggested the money Abby's father had used to buy the home place, money paid to him by Sam Fremantle of Lewis, South Carolina, as wages for the 8 years her daddy and his brothers had stayed on after the state's war had ended, had been conscience money. Abigail had held her tongue when Molly said that. Molly and Jim and the others were young and didn't understand anything but the veriest good and the veriest bad. But inside she had rolled her eyes and said to herself, "Conscience money? Well, is there any money cleaner than that?" So the Fremantles had settled in Hemingford home, and Abby, the last of Daddy and Mama's children, had been born right here on the home place. Her father had bested those who would not buy from niggers and those who would not sell to them. He had bought land a little smidge at a time, so as not to alarm those who were worried about those black bastards over Columbus way. He had been the first man in Polk County to try crop rotation, the first man to try chemical fertilizer. And in March of 1902, Gary Seitz had come to the house to tell John Fremantle that he had been voted into the Grange. He was the first black man to belong to the Grange in the whole state of Nebraska. That year had been a topper. She reckoned that anyone, looking back over her life, could pick out one year and say, that was the best. It seemed that for everyone there was one spell of seasons when everything came together, smooth and glorious and full of wonder. It was only later that you might wonder why it had happened that way. It was like putting 10 different savory things in the cold pantry all at once, so each took on a bit of the other's flavors. The mushrooms had a taste of ham, and the ham of mushrooms. The venison had the slightest wild taste of partridge, and the partridge had the tiniest hint of cucumbers. Later on in life, you might wish that the good things which all befell you in your one special year had spread themselves out a little more, that you could maybe take one of the golden things and kind of transplant it right down in the middle of a 3-year stretch you couldn't remember a blessed good thing about, or even a bad one, and so you knew that things had just gone on the way they were supposed to in the world God had created and Adam and Eve had half uncreated. The washing had gone out, the floors had been scrubbed, the babies had been cared for, the clothes had been mended. 3 years with nothing to break up the gray even flow of time but Easter and the 4th of July and Thanksgiving and Christmas. But there was no answering the ways God set about his wonders to perform, and for Abby Fremantle as well as her father, 02 had been a topper. Abby thought she was the only one in the family, other than her daddy that was, that understood what a great, nearly unprecedented thing it was to be invited into the Grange. He would be the first Negro Granger in Nebraska, and very possibly the first Negro Granger in the United States. He had no illusions about the price he and his family would pay in the form of crude jokes and racial slurs from those men, Ben Convey, chief among them, who were set against the idea. But he also saw that Gary Seitz was handing him something more than a chance at survival. Gary was giving him a chance to prosper with the rest of the Corn Belt. As a member of the Grange, his problems buying good seed would end. The necessity of taking his crops all the way to Omaha to find a buyer would likewise end. It might mean the end of the water rights squabble he had been having with Ben Convey, who was rabid on the subjects of niggers like John Fremantle and nigger lovers like Gary Seitz. It might even mean that the county tax assessor would stop his endless gouging. So John Fremantle accepted the invitation, and the vote went his way, by quite a comfortable margin, too. And there were nasty cracks and jokes about how a coon had got caught in the Grange Hall loft, and about how when a nigger baby went to heaven and got his little black wings, you called it a bat instead of an angel. And Ben Convey went around for a while telling people that the only reason the Mystic Tie Grange had voted John Fremantle in was because the children's fair was coming up pretty soon, and they needed a nigger to play the African orangutan. John Fremantle pretended not to hear these things, and at home he would quote from the Bible.
A soft answer turneth away wrath. And, brethren, as ye reap, so shalt ye surely sow. And his favorite, spoken not in humility but in grim expectation, the meek shall inherit the earth. And little by little he had brought his neighbors around. Not all of them, not the rabid ones like Ben Convey and his half-brother George, not the Arnolds and the Deacons, but all the others. In 1903 they had taken dinner with Gary Seitz and his family right in the parlor, just as good as white. And in 1902 Abigail had played her guitar at the Grange Hall, and not in the minstrel show either. She had played in the White Folks Talent Show at the end of the year. Her mother had been dead set against that. It was one of the few times in her life when she let her opposition to one of her husband's ideas out in front of the children. Except by then the boys were damned near middle-aged, and John himself had a good deal more than a touch of snow on the mountain.
"I know how it was," she said, weeping. "You and Seitz and that Frank Fenner, you whip this up together. That's fine for them, John Fremantle, but what's got into your head? They're white. You go hunker down with them in the backyard and talk about plowing. You can even go downtown and have a spot of beer with them, if that neat Jackson will let you into his saloon. Fine. I know what you've been through these last years. None better. I know you've kept a smile on your face when it must have hurt like a grass fire in your heart. But this is different. This is your own daughter. What you gonna say if she gets up there in her pretty white dress and they laughs at her? What you gonna do if they throws rotten tomatoes at her like they did at Brick Sullivan when he tried to sing in the minstrel show? And what are you going to say if she comes to you with all those tomatoes all over the front of her dress and asks, 'Why, Daddy, why did they do it? And why did you let them do it?' 'Well, Rebecca,' John had answered, 'I guess we better leave it up to her and David.' David had been her first husband. In 1902, Abigail Fremantle had become Abigail Trotz. David Trotz was a black farmhand from over Valparaiso way, and he had come pretty near 30 miles one way to court her. John Fremantle had once said to Rebecca that the bear had caught old Davy right and proper, and he had been trotting plenty. There were plenty who had laughed at her first husband and said things like, 'I guess I know who wears the pants in that family.' But David had not been a weakling, only quiet and thoughtful. When he told John and Rebecca Fremantle, 'Whatever Abigail thinks is right, why, I reckon that's what's to do,' she had blessed him for it and told her mother and father she intended to go ahead. So on December 27th, 1902, already 3 months gone with her first, she had mounted the Grange Hall stage in the dead silence that had ensued when the master of ceremonies had announced her name. Just before her, Gretchen Tillions had been on and had done a racy French dance, showing her ankles and petticoats to the raucous whistles, cheers, and stamping feet of the men in the audience. She stood in the thick silence, knowing how black her face and neck must look in her new white dress, and her heart was thudding terribly in her chest, and she was thinking, 'I forgot every word, every single word. I promised Daddy I wouldn't cry no matter what. I wouldn't cry. But Ben Convey's out there, and when Ben Convey yells, "Nigger," then I guess I'll cry. Oh, why did I ever get into this? Mama was right. I've got above my place, and I'll pay for it.' The hall was filled with white faces turned up to look at her. Every chair was filled, and there were two rows of standees at the back of the hall. Kerosene lanterns glowed and flared. The red velvet curtains were pulled back in swoops of cloth and tied with gold ropes. And she thought, 'I'm Abigail Fremantle Trotz. I play well and I sing well. I do not know these things because anyone told me.' And so she began to sing "The Old Rugged Cross" into the moveless silence, her fingers picking melody. Then, picking up a strum, the slightly stronger melody of "How I Love My Jesus," and then stronger still, "Camp Meeting in Georgia." Now people were swaying back and forth almost in spite of themselves. Some were grinning and tapping their knees. She sang a medley of Civil War songs, "When Johnny Comes Marching Home," "Marching Through Georgia," and "Goober Peas." More smiles at that one. Many of these men, Grand Army of the Republic veterans, had eaten more than a few goober peas during their time in the service. She finished with "Tenting Tonight on the Old Campground," and as the last chord floated away into a silence that was now thoughtful and sad,
She thought, "Now if you want to throw your tomatoes or whatever, you go on and do it. I played and sang my best, and I was real fine." When the last chord floated into silence, that silence held for a long, almost enchanted instant, as though the people in those seats and the others standing at the back of the hall had been taken far away, so far they could not find their way back all at once. Then the applause broke and rolled over her in a wave, long and sustained, making her blush, making her feel confused, hot and shivery all over. She saw her mother weeping openly, and her father and David beaming at her. She had tried to leave the stage then, but cries of "Encore! Encore!" broke out. And so, smiling, she played "Diggin' My Potatoes." That song was just a tiny bit risky, but Abby guessed that if Gretchen Tillions could show her ankles in public, then she could sing a song that was the teeniest bit bawdy. She was, after all, a married woman. "Someone's been digging my potatoes. They've left 'em in my bin. And now that someone's gone, and see the trouble I've got in." There were 6 more verses like that, some even worse, and she sang every one, and at the last line of each the roar of approval was louder. And later she thought that if she had done anything wrong that night, it was singing that song, which was exactly the kind of song they probably expected to hear a nigger sing. She finished to another thunderous ovation and fresh cries of encore. She remounted the stage, and when the crowd had quietened, she said, "Thank you all very much. I hope you won't think I'm being forward if I ask to sing just one more song, which I've learned special but never ever expected to sing here. But it is just about the best song I know, on account of what President Lincoln and this country did for me and mine, even before I was born." They were very quiet now, listening closely. Her family sat stock still, all together near the left aisle, like a spot of blackberry jam on a white handkerchief. "On account of what happened back in the middle of the States War," she went steadily on, "my family was able to come here and live with the fine neighbors that we have." Then she played and sang "The Star-Spangled Banner," and everyone stood up and listened, and some of the handkerchiefs came out again, and when she had finished, they applauded fit to raise the roof. That was the proudest day of her life. She stirred awake a little after noon and sat up, blinking in the sunlight, an old woman of 108. She had slept wrong on her back, and it was a pure misery to her. Would be all day if she knew anything about it. "Well, a day," she said, and stood up carefully. She began to go down the porch steps, holding carefully to the rickety railing, wincing at the daggers of pain in her back and the prickles in her legs. Her circulation was not what it had once been. Why should it be? Time after time she had warned herself about the consequences of falling asleep in that rocker. She would doze off, and all the old times would come back, and that was wonderful. Oh, yes, it was. Better than watching a play on the television. But there was hell to pay when she woke up. She could lecture herself all she liked, but she was like an old dog that splays itself out by a fireplace. If she sat in the sun, she went to sleep, that was all. She no longer had a say in the matter. She reached the bottom of the steps, paused to let her legs catch up with her, then hawked up a goodish gob of snot and spat it into the dirt. When she felt about as usual, except for the misery in her back, she walked slowly around to the privy her grandson Victor had put behind the house in 1931. She went inside, primly shut the door, and put the hook through the eye just as if there was a whole crowd of folks out there instead of a few blackbirds, and sat down. A moment later she began to make water and sighed contentedly. Here was another thing about being old no one ever thought to tell you, or was it just that you never listened? You stopped knowing when you had to make water. Seemed like you lost all the feeling down there in your bladder, and if you weren't careful, first thing you knew you had to be changing your clothes. It wasn't like her to be dirty, and so she came out here to squat 6 or 7 times a day, and at night she kept the chamber pot beside the bed. Molly's Jim told her once that she was like a dog that couldn't pass a fire plug without at least lifting one leg to salute it, and that had made her laugh until tears spouted from her eyes and streamed down her cheeks. Molly's Jim was an advertising executive in Chicago and getting along all right smart. Had been anyway.
She supposed he was gone with the rest of them. Molly, too. Bless their hearts, they were with Jesus now. The last year or so, Molly and Jim were about the only ones who came out to the place to see her anymore. The rest seemed to have forgot she was alive. But she could understand that. She had lived past her time. She was like a dinosaur which had no business still wearing its flesh over its bones, a thing whose proper place was in a museum or a graveyard. She could understand them not wanting to come see her, but what she couldn't understand was why they didn't want to come back and see the land. There wasn't much left, no, just a matter of acres out of the original large freehold. It was still theirs, however, still their land. But black folks didn't seem to care so much about land anymore. There were, in fact, those that actually seemed ashamed of it. They had gone off to make their way in the cities, and most of them, like Jim, came along real well. But how it made her heart ache to think of all those black folks with their faces set away from the land. Molly and Jim had wanted to put in a flushing toilet for her the year before last, and had been hurt when she refused. She tried to explain so they could understand, but all Molly had been able to say over and over again was, "Mother Abigail, you are 106 years old. How do you think I feel knowing you are going out there to squat down some days when it's only 10 degrees above zero? Don't you know that the shock of the cold could do your heart in?" "When the Lord wants me, the Lord will take me," Abigail said, and she was knitting. And so, of course, they thought that was what she was looking at, and couldn't see the way they rolled their eyes at each other. Some things you couldn't let go of. It seemed like that was another thing the young people didn't know. Now, back in 82, when she had turned 100, Kathy and David had offered her a TV set, and she had taken them up on that one. The TV was a marvelous machine for passing the time when you were by your onesome. But when Christopher and Susie came and said they wanted to get her on the city water, she had turned them down just as she had turned down Molly and Jim on their kind offer of a flushing toilet. They had argued that her dug well was shallow, and it could go dry if there was another summer like 1988 when the drought came. It was true, but she just went on saying no. They thought she had flipped her wig, of course, that she was taking coat after coat of senility the way a floor takes varnish. But she herself believed her mind was pretty nigh as good as it had ever been. She hoisted herself off the privy's seat, dusted lime down through the hole, and slowly let herself out into the sunlight again. She kept her privy sweet, but they were dank old places, no matter how sweet they smelled. It was as if the voice of God had been whispering in her ear when Chris and Susie offered to see that she was put on the city water. The voice of God even way back when Molly and Jim wanted to get her that china throne with the flush lever on the side. God did speak to folks. Hadn't he talked to Noah about the ark, telling him how many cubits long and how many deep and how many wide? Yes. And she believed he had spoken to her as well, not from a burning bush or out of a pillar of fire, but in a still small voice that said, "Abby, you are going to need your hand pump. You enjoy your electricity all you want, Abby, but you keep those oil lamps of yours full and keep the wicks trimmed. You keep the cold pantry just the way your mother kept it before you. And mind you, don't let any of the young folks talk you into anything you know to be against my will, Abby. They are your kin, but I am your father." She paused in the middle of the yard, looking out at the sea of corn, broken only by the dirt road going north toward Duncan and Columbus. 3 miles up from her house it went to tar. The corn was going to be fine this year, and it was such a shame that no one would be around to harvest it but the rooks. It was sad to think that the big red harvesting machines were going to stay in their barns this September. Sad to think there would be no husking bees and barn dances. Sad to think that, for the first time in the last 108 years, she would not be here in Hemmingford home to see the time of the change as summer gave in to pagan, jocund autumn. She would love this summer all the more because it was to be her last. She felt that clearly. And she would not be laid to rest here, but farther west, in a strange country. It was bitter. She shuffled over to the tire swing and set it to moving. It was an old tractor tire that her brother Lucas had hung here in 1922. The rope had been changed many times between then and now, but never the tire.
Now the canvas showed through in many places, and on the inside rim there was a deep depression where generations of young buttocks had set themselves down. Below the tire was a deep and dusty groove in the earth where the grass had long since given up trying to grow, and on the limb where the rope was tied, the bark had been rubbed away to show